I think I want to shag my mum and I'm frightened that my dad's going to castrate me. I reckon everyone else does too. Right? And that's kind of the extent of his research, right? He did no, nada, zero actual clinical research, nothing. At a time when
all the Freud fans are going to be really mad at you today.
They're going to be super mad at me. Super mad. At a time when people were doing research, like, funnily enough, in the Soviet Union, where they wouldn't touch Freud with a barge pole. Like, they were doing research on psychotherapy. They were measuring blood pressure and heart rate and training people in relaxation skills to overcome anxiety disorders and gathering outcome, clinical outcome data and stuff like that. You know, there were, even in the late 19th century, people were gathering outcome data and like clinical, basic clinical research. And Freud was antagonistic to that. Like, he and his followers did away with that completely. So I really am serious when I say I think it was a huge step backwards for the development of evidence-based practice and mental health. It wasn't really until the 1960s that we recovered from that and people began again to do research studies on psychotherapy. And when they did, they suddenly discovered loads of things that were inconsistent or completely incompatible with what Freud had been saying. So I mean, I really cherish, like, I think what research has told us about mental health is something that we have to cherish. It's incredibly valuable. And so that's partly why maybe I'm a bit hard on self-improvement gurus who are maybe misdirecting people away from that. Like, towards,
it's a problem, dude. It's a problem. That whole wellness sphere, you know, there are different ways people get their money hooks into you, get their influence hooks into you. And, you know, it's crazy where you can meet people under the banner of self-help and what you can get them to give you. Right.
There's one other thing I wanted to say about that, actually. It's like a hobby horse of mine, right? And it's a general point, a meta point. So the sophists in the ancient world would give speeches. And they would impart wisdom to people. They claimed to be wise. The first great sophist was Protagoras in Athens, and he claimed to be the wisest man in the world. And he would give elaborate speeches to people, and he would teach them slogans that they would memorize, like, man is the measure of all things. And the sophist would teach people other moral slogans, like justice consists in helping your friends and harming your enemies.
Were they the ones that came up with the F. Trudeau slogan?
Yeah, like that bumper sticker, like slogans. So they would, because they thought imparting wisdom is like teaching people stuff in a speech or in a slogan. They go away and memorize it, and you've kind of like taught them some things, which might seem obvious in a way, but there's a problem with this, right? So it leads to a problem that's well known in modern psychology. We call it the problem of verbal rule-governed behavior. So let me very quickly explain a little research study that has seismic implications for how we do mental health stuff.
Yeah, please.
Right. So you get two groups of people and you have them do an experiment where they perform a simple task and they get a reward, or they maybe even get punished or something. Like, so they make like a buzzer sounds if they get it wrong, or they get a mild electric shock or something like that. So in this experiment, you have to perform a very simple task in a particular way. Let's say you have to press a button 3 times and then you get a reward. If you press it twice or you press it 4 times, you get like a horrible klaxon sounds or whatever, right? In one group, the participants have to figure this out through trial and error. So they press the button and play around with it, and eventually they figure out if they press it 3 times in a row, that gives them the reward every time. So they just keep doing it. And the other group, you tell them in writing or verbally, if you press the button 3 times, then you'll get a reward, right? And so both groups eventually, like the first group immediately, second group through trial and error, end up pressing the button 3 times, getting the reward, right? That's the first phase of the experiment. Second phase of the experiment is where it gets interesting. You change the rules so that now you have to press the button 4 times to get a reward, right? So what happens next is the key. The group that learned through trial and error and figured it out themselves will figure out pretty quickly that pressing it 3 times doesn't work anymore. It gets them like a negative, like it gets a punishment or whatever, like, or nothing. And they'll figure out through trial and error again that they have to press it 4 times. So they'll adapt, right, Dean? The group that you told press the button 3 times will not only take longer to adapt, they'll be surprisingly persistent in keeping doing something even when it's not working. So rule-governed behavior is surprisingly obstinate in the face of negative feedback. Now, the reason that clinicians got really interested in this is kind of like I mentioned earlier, clients come into therapy and they'll say that they're using a self-help technique or some coping strategy that they just made up themselves, right? And it worked. They'll go, it worked in some situations, right? Or it worked temporarily. But then in the longer term, it's maybe causing problems. And so as a clinician, over and over again, you have the feeling of like, well, why do you keep doing it? It's like the definition of insanity is to keep doing something even though it's not working.
Expect a different result, yeah.
And in many cases, it's because they acquired it verbally rather than through trial and error learning. That helps
experience.
That explains in part. So they're overly dependent on a formula. So scoot back in time, right? The sophists would teach people a moral formula, like justice consists in helping your friends and harming your enemies or something like that. Or, you know, lying is unjust. Or, you know, like little slogans or phrases like that, formula like that. Socrates' big innovation was to come along and say that you can pick apart any of these definitions and they don't hold good in many situations. So he courage was defined at the time by many people as standing your ground in the face of the enemy, right? That was a familiar definition of courage. Socrates said, what if you're in the cavalry? Like, because the cavalry charge into the enemy. So does that mean that they're not courageous? And people say, okay.
Like, Socrates with all the questions, eh? He just couldn't stop asking questions.
Like, he'd say, what about during a tactical retreat, like the one that we had to have following the Battle of Delium? Like, and they'd be like, okay, well, that's different. Then you retreat from the enemy and you've got to fight at the same time. Like, you know, so then courage isn't standing your ground. He said, what about the Spartans? They charge into the enemy as well instead of staying in formation. And they'd be like, okay. Like, so the formula works in some situations, but not others. So the point being that Socrates thought that wisdom cannot be commodified. He can't buy wisdom in the sense that you go to a greengrocer's and buy a bag of onions, right? People thought you could go to the sophist and pay them money and they would just teach you what wisdom is, what justice is, what courage is. And they give you like a formula and you just have to parrot that. And then you'll be wise, right? And Socrates thought, no, none of these verbal rules are adequate. None of these verbal definitions are adequate. Real wisdom is a process. It's a thinking skill. So someone who's genuinely wise is able to see that these definitions work in some situations, but not in others. And they're able to think for themselves and make a distinction between the situations where this definition works and a situation where it's no longer applicable. And they can keep adapting the definition and refining it like somebody who's learning through trial and error. Like, they're adaptable and flexible in their thinking. It's not, so the sophist thought wisdom is like understood in terms of content.
It was a package. The sophist thought wisdom was a package. You give you a formula, some talking
just
points.
Just memorize this.
In the world.
Repeat these talking points. Repeat these formulas, right? And and then follow this rule, like, and then that'll work, right? You're going to love this. Zip forward in time. Out comes a best-selling self-help book called 12 Rules, right? And it consists, at the beginning, that book opens with an argument in favor of having self-help rules, which is completely at odds with the whole Socratic method and the idea that having simple rules like tidy your room is going to work until it doesn't, right? It's going to work sometimes, but not other times. It's not going to work when your girlfriend really like needs you to give her emotional support. And you're like, hang on a minute, well, I'm going to tidy my room, right? It's not going to work if you've got intense rage at somebody because you've got a really prejudiced way of thinking about it, and then you go and tidy your room. That's not going to change your underlying beliefs.
You're still mad. Still mad, right?
It's not going to work if you've got OCD and now you're compulsively tidying your room, right? As a way of trying to mask your feelings of anxiety. Like, so sometimes it might work, other times it's not going to work. Giving someone the verbal formula, do this and you'll feel better, isn't really that helpful. What would be more helpful would be if they were capable of thinking for themselves and figuring out today tidying my room would probably be a healthy thing to do. Tomorrow, I should just leave my room like in a mess, deal with that later, because it'd be much better for me to spend the day hanging out with my family, like spend more time with them or something like that, right?
Going to get a job or sprucing up my resume or whatever.
Be flexible and adaptive in your thinking. Sometimes we call that creative problem solving, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a meta skill. Someone who knows how to do creative problem solving, like has cognitive flexibility, will pick and choose coping strategies that suit different situations. What the research shows is no single coping strategy is like a panacea that's going to work across the board. And the risk is that you find a coping strategy that works sometimes and then you cling on to it rigidly, particularly because if it's been taught to you as a rule, you'll, like the guy with the buzzer, carry on doing that. Even so, for example,
and getting angrier and angrier and angrier the entire time because those rules have nothing to, they're external, they're for other people, they're fugazi.
Anger often is triggered by frustration, right? There's different types of anger. One type of anger is caused by frustration, and frustration comes from doing something that's rewarding and then finding yourself in a situation where you it no longer works. I don't understand. This normally works when I do it. People normally listen to me when I say this. They're not listening anymore. Like, and then you get really frustrated and wound up, right? And that you're setting that self up. You're setting yourself up for that. If you have like a rule, a self-help rule that you follow rigidly, like, and not adaptively. Self-help isn't about learning a bunch of rules and following them. It's about being able to think critically and flexibly for yourself and adapt to the demands of the situations that you're facing. Socrates totally understood that, right? That's why he said you have to question all of these formulas and definitions. The sophists give these speeches, but we should be sitting down engaging in dialectic and bandying ideas about and like exploring their limitations, not just kind of like memorizing. You can't become wise just by parroting what someone else has said. You need to gain understanding, and you gain understanding by figuring out what the limits of a concept or the limits of a rule actually are in practice and when you need to tweak it or adapt it a little bit. You have to question and examine things, and only you can do that for yourself. Like, you're going to have to. I hate to break it to you guys. You're going to have to think for yourselves. Like, I know that hurts. I know it's painful, right? But you're gonna have to think for yourself. You and someone spoon feeding you platitudes like make your bed. What's the other one? Like
pet a cat.
Yeah. Or any of these other kind of like strategies, like go to the gym and vent your anger.
Yeah.
These formulas are not going to work consistently. That's why, don't you think that we could just do a research study? Let's do a research study. We get a bunch of young men and we get them all to tidy their room each day, and we'll just monitor their levels of depression and anxiety. And boom, we've proven, like beyond dispute, that tidying your room cures clinical depression. So, well, that would save a lot of money in the NHS. Like, you know, we don't need to bother training therapists anymore. We'll just get everybody.
That's the thing. I'm unaware of a room tidying study therapy that exists. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Because it would work until it doesn't.
Yeah.
Right. And because it's not flexible enough.
Well, like, you have the same problem after you clean your room that you
They're selling your self-help lemon.
Yeah.
Right. It looks like it works because it works temporarily, or it works for some people and it doesn't work for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it's not real, right? You need to think for yourselves and develop problem solving skills and a variety of coping strategies, and you need to choose intelligently. So I'll give you another example. Like, therapists and self-help gurus tell people that, say, in a relationship conflict, sometimes you've got to learn to be assertive with the other person, and sometimes you've got to put your foot down and speak your mind firmly. But sometimes you also need to be mindful and accepting and tolerant of disagreement, right? And so there's a kind of conflict between, should I say nothing and just kind of shrug this off and accept it, or should I be assertive and try and change it? There's a classic conflict between, do you tolerate something, or do you try and change it?
The Locker Room on Cryer Media West is brought to you by Ardent Roof Systems. Sign up for the annual Ardent Roof Systems Charity Golf Tournament. Do that today. Spots are filling up. Early bird pricing in effect until May 1st, and there's still room for sponsors. Give Stacy a shout or drop me a line. I'll hook you up with Stacy. Friday, July 5th at the Ranch Golf and Country Club, one of the best courses in Alberta. Your 18-hole round includes breakfast, the famous ranch steak dinner, a massive silent auction, a lot of fun, and a chance to give back to a very worthy cause, the Stollery Child Life Program. This will be the fifth year, and to date, Stacy and Arden have raised over $65,000 for the Stollery. If you're looking for any info or you'd like to register yourself or your team, ardenroofsystems.com. We'll see you there. This is one of my favorite tournaments of the year.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Nickel, four-time Winter Olympian and host of Dropping In, a podcast with Mercedes. This is a podcast where I interview a bunch of different people. I get the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as I share my stories along the way. Now you can drop in at droppingin.com or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. I'll see you soon.
Right. Well, and that's the struggle I have in stoicism. Just to quickly ask you a question before I let you continue. You know, what I talk about when I think about stoicism or dealing with other people with the idea of stoicism, you know, you find yourself in this unique position of saying, man, is what I'm, and I believe it was Seneca who said, I will speak when I know what I have to say isn't better left unsaid. That's the fight in my mind all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, listen, do I contribute to the solution here, or is this just apply the dichotomy of control, walk away because you can do nothing?
So the Stoics don't want you to do nothing, right? So Epictetus taught his students three disciplines, but the two that we'll focus on is the discipline of fear and desire, which is about emotional acceptance and not getting upset by things, learning to kind of put up with things, endure them, and shrug them off. It's tolerance, right? But the other discipline is the discipline of justice, or discipline of action, he calls it. And that's about acting with justice and commitment to your values and courage in the face of adversity, right? It's about doing stuff, right? Like being willing to... The Stoics were known for political opposition. Some of them died opposing autocrats, right? So they weren't passive or quietistic, like sit-at-home types, do-nothing types. They weren't doormats. Like, they were highly disciplined. Marcus went to war, right? They did
a lot.
A lot, right, most of the time. So you have to choose. Now, interestingly, Epictetus says only you can choose, like, when you accept and when you try to change the situation. And he says, I can't tell you that. Like, and he gives a famous analogy, right, which a lot of people I don't think understand, but the analogy he gives... He said, how does a bull know that it can kill a lion? Now, bulls can toss lions on their horns, right? If they're big enough and strong enough. And he said, how does a bull know that it can do that? The female cattle in the herd can't do it. The calves can't do it. They're at risk of being picked off by predators like lions. But the strongest bulls in the herd will fight the lions off and toss them in the air on their horns, right? How does it know that it can do that? And he said, his analogy is, how would you know that you could stand up against a tyrant like Domitian or maybe Hadrian, let's say, or Nero, right? He said, because some people, wouldn't be able to cope with the stress, the anxiety, they'd be too afraid. They wouldn't have the self-mastery and discipline to be able to put themselves in that situation and take on an autocrat. You know, they'd be better to leave it to someone like Thrasea, the leader of the Stoic opposition, who has the courage and the integrity and isn't afraid of dying. He said, I don't expect everybody to be capable of doing this, right? You need to decide, can I put myself in a high-stress situation and still cope with it? Or am I just going to succumb to it? Is it going to be biting off more than I can chew? How does the bull know that it can do that? And he says, through experience, right? Its entire life growing up, it gradually figures out that there's certain things. Maybe it kind of approaches a lion and gets its nose slashed or something, backs off, and then realizes over time, as it grows bigger and stronger, it's more able to do it. Their analogy would be wrestling and sparring, right? So doing stoicism is like being a pancratiast or a wrestler in ancient Greek or Rome. You pick a sparring partner. But if you pick somebody that's too weak for you, then you're not really going to develop your skill. But if you pick somebody that's much more experienced and much bigger than you, you're just going to get like your head kicked in again. You know, you're going to just get pummeled into the ground every time. You're not going to really benefit or learn. So Epictetus would say you're the only person that can figure that out for yourself based on trial and error, right? You'll know, like, if you keep gradually putting yourself in the presence of challenges, you'll figure out what's too much and what's not enough. Mm-hmm. In terms of charge, and you figure out this guy's about my level as a
the nuance partner. The nuance of the fight, you're going to figure that out through the experience of fighting, right?
So a wrestler, so like a rule governed behavior, like some other guy coming along going, just always, this goes right back to our beginning of stand up straight and stare people in the eye. Yeah, maybe in some situations that's going to work, like in the sense that maybe there's some guys that you could spar with in wrestling, and then there's maybe other guys that are going to punch your lights out. Right. And you think, I'm not ready to spar this guy. Right. It would be suicide. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm maybe not ready to kind of like stand up and go face to face this guy and try and make myself like, you know, seem more manly or tougher than him or whatever. That's not going to end well. Mm-hmm. Right. Common sense and trial and error learning should allow you to go, okay, this guy's like about my level, or he's maybe a little bit better than me, or I can learn something. This guy's too much. This guy's not enough. Like, it's too easy. Like, so. So Epictetus is basically saying you should engage with situation problems that you think you can take on, like, unless you're not ready to, and it's going to be overwhelming for you. Mm. We do this in exposure therapy, right? When we get people, if someone has a phobia and we want them to say they have a cat phobia, right? Now, especially if they suffer from, they're prone to panic attacks, like, you can push people further than they normally think they can go, but if you threw someone in a room full of cats and they were prone to panic attacks and you didn't prepare them and you didn't kind of like, you just kind of sprung it on them as a surprise, you'd probably make them worse, right? They'd have a panic attack, they'd freak out.
Sounds like an exciting part of CBT that I might enjoy though. Like, it might be fun.
Sometimes we do push people to face extreme fears, but we usually prepare them and the therapist is usually there with them. Like, and maybe we coach them through the process of what to do and what not to do, so they're prepared to do it. Like, you have a coach helping you or whatever, right? Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. We create what's called a hierarchy of exposure normally. And so, like, a lot of it, we'd say roughly, if we say we rate the things that make you anxious from 0 to 10, often we'd start around about 7 out of 10, right? So quite far up the scale, but we're not going to make you do something that's 10 out of 10 immediately, like, without any preparation, because that would be like one of the calves in the herds trying to tackle a lion, or like you walking into a bar in South London, like, in just like stand up
going toe to toe with some loud
on a Friday night, staring everybody in that, like, you're going to be an A&E, like, going to be in casualty, like, by the end of the night probably, but, you know, you got a glass in your face, like, mm-hmm. What's that actor called? Who's the guy that's in Gladiator, the British actor that died? Oliver British Reed.
The guy that played Dumbledore. What was his name?
No, Oliver Reed.
Oliver Reed, yeah.
Oliver Reed's in Gladiator. Did you know he was like a matinee idol? But you know, he was a heavy drinker and stuff. He's a Hellraiser.
No, right? I didn't know that.
Oh, no, he's like a notorious. Like, he was a notorious Hellraiser. He was friends with the drummer out the Who. Like, they were both like real heavy drinkers. Anyway, I used to live in Wimbledon. Like, Oliver Reed, the guy that plays the slave, the gladiator school trainer and Gladiator, he has scars on his cheek, right?
Yeah.
Because somebody smashed a glass in his face in a bar in Wimbledon when he got in a kind of drunken brawl one night, right? Like, and he thought it was the end of his career as an actor. Like, but he was such a charismatic guy, he managed to kind of, you know, continue his career beyond that. But anyway, that's what happens if you follow the wrong self-help advice, maybe.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's amazing, right? I'm just looking at a picture of Oliver Reed now with the scar and everything. He played the slave master that bought Russell Crowe. Yeah, right. He turned out to be a pretty decent dude.
He said, you sold me queer giraffes. like or something like that. We say something weird like that, right? My wife loves that movie, right?
Oh, dude, so do I. It's one of my all-time favorites.
The point being, you know, you can't just take like a rigid verbal format, even if it seems like good advice. Mm-hmm. The skill, the real self-help skill, is at a different level from that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's you can't just use the same. It would be like you've got a toolbox and there's just a hammer in it. Right. And that's all you know how to use. Saying something, it's like someone saying they're going to train you to be an electrician. Right. And they don't know, they just give you a hammer. Like, or maybe if you're lucky, they just give you a screwdriver. Right. And that's off you go. Right. You think, well, I'm probably going to need like a bunch of other tools. Right. And then I'm going to need to know how to use them and when to use them and stuff like that. Right. Mm-hmm. But what you get from online self help is more like, here's a hammer.
Yeah, yeah. Like, here's what you say in this situation. It's like the apologetics of religion, right? Teaching people to defend their faith. So there's really never any critical thought.
Like Epictetus says, in a relationship, you might think, is this a good time to lay down boundaries with my partner? Or is that just going to like backfire? Or is this the time to kind of keep my mouth shut and just wait like until things have, the dust has settled, and then maybe I should try and be assertive later. So you need to pick, what's the expression? Choose your fights.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like, and that's a great point, because, you know, as with any ideology or any operating system or any perception, right, it doesn't matter, the values that you live by, and mine are relatively new. It's been in the last 5-6 years that I've really gotten into CBT, a lot of your stuff, holiday stuff, you know, and then obviously source material like the, you know, Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius. But I go back to meditations all the time because it's source material. It's cardinal. It's like, oh, okay, this guy was writing this book to himself about what he had learned in his life, about how he had managed and what was important to him, right? But it's so universally shared because he, you know, through the entire experience of reading about Marcus Aurelius, what went into him. Now, of course, your new book, which really gets into what Stoicism is to Marcus Aurelius and why he needed it. Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor, available anywhere you get your books. Amazon, I believe it's already a number one bestseller on Amazon. It's not self-help. You know, Stoicism is the opposite of that. It is the encouragement of you to respond well in a variety of ways and to think critically, zoom out, and understand your role in your life and not be the center of the universe, right? Like, this is just the business of life to that point.
It's a philosophy of life, and it has within it coping strategies and techniques and skills and maxims and coping statements. But more fundamentally, it's a philosophy. So it's encouraging you to think for yourself, mm-hmm. and stand on your own two feet. And many of the techniques are not just changes in behavior, but there would be changes in perspective. So what the Stoics want you to encourage you to do is to reevaluate your thinking, from different perspectives. And this is a high level technique. You know, mm-hmm. looking at it from the perspective of somebody who's about to die, would you still feel the same way looking back in your life? If you imagine looking at your life from a much broader perspective, like the view from above, you know, how do you see this situation?
Would you be proud of how you're reacting to something? Are you proud of what your behaviors are that day? Yeah.
And there might be different ways that you choose to respond to different situations or different techniques that seem appropriate at different times. You're going to have to figure that out for yourself and it might be for some people, I guarantee you that there's some guy out there for whom tidying his room is going to save his life. Mm-hmm. It might prevent him from committing suicide. It might get him out of a deep hole of addiction. I'm sure it will. And I guarantee you that there'll be someone else out there for whom kind of doing the opposite would have the equal similar benefits. Mm-hmm. Right. So the answer really is that we have to figure out ourselves, but over dependence on any single rigid coping strategy is a recipe for disaster. Generally speaking, because you're going to find yourself eventually in a situation where it doesn't work anymore. A good example is the way that some people speak to their buddy in a bar is not going to serve them well is a way of speaking to a potential employer in a job interview in many situations, right? Am I right? Like, so, but, and that might be obvious. Like, to many people, that's obvious. You go, I put on one persona when I'm talking to my buddy in the bar, in a dive bar. Like, maybe I put on a different persona when I'm sitting in a job interview and I'm applying for a job. It's not at my granny's funeral. I maybe acted a bit differently, right? Like, I have a different persona. Like, we all do. We're authentic chameleons. We adapt to the situation. Apart from some people, there's some people that don't. So there's some people that jostle up to, have you seen Trainspotting? There's a guy, one of the guys in Trainspotting goes to
all-time favorite movie. It's awesome.
He's on speed or something, right?
Yeah.
So the way he acts in job interviews is kind of like how he would act with his buddies or whatever, and it's like a bit of a train wreck, right? So there are people that will walk into a job interview and not really know how to adapt. And they think the joke that had everybody falling about laughing in the dive bar is maybe going to come across well in the job interview as well. And what works in one situation, or the way that they spoke to people when they were in the military, is going to maybe be okay in the cafeteria and an office when they're like, now they've got a job in HR or something in the civilian world. Maybe it's not like, maybe you have to adapt. Like, what works in one environment, maybe the way you talk to your family at home, is that going to work if you talk to strangers that way? Like, out in the street, like, so we've got to be careful that we don't get addicted to behavior, ways of thinking, ways of coping that work okay in one setting but would be maladaptive, counterproductive, harmful, stupid, whatever you would call it, if we try to do it in another situation. And sure, for many people have that flexibility, so it's natural for them. Like, but you see people who get into problems don't have that. Like, and so they'll talk to you the way they talk to their family, right? Which just comes across as neurotic, maybe. Or they try and behave in a job interview the way they talk to them, but then you kind of think, why? Like, why would you like speak like that to
situation?
Like,
yeah, it's funny, and it's one of those like little nuances of personalities, right? And I think people feel like, you know, I'm being true to myself. I speak from the hip. This is who I am, you know, and I applied, you know, it's because I read this book or I grew up with this, or this is how I acted.
Andrew Tate gives dating advice that might work. Like, if you, it might work
in prison.
In prison. It might work in prison, right? In a Romanian prison, maybe it works really well. Or it might work if all the girls you're dating are hookers.
Yeah.
Or work for you.
Yeah.
And what do they call it? Like web sex cam.
Webcam. Yeah. Cam girls.
If all your girlfriends are cam girls, maybe like
how you do it.
That's how you get, you know, like talk to them on a date. But if they're not, like if your girlfriend's like a professor at a local university.
Or just has a normal job.
A normal human being. Not that cam girls aren't, but if your girlfriend's not a cam, like a sex cam girl, whatever, like then maybe talking to her in that way is not going to impress her.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe it's not going to work. Like, but you know, like what seems plausible, and we've got to be really careful that we don't absorb advice that seems plausible in a crazy, unnatural situation.
Well, but you know what? It's funny because I'm a big fan of, like, I think people should experience life and experience all the failures that life has to offer, because I think failure is the only way we really learn from things, right? Mm-hmm. So to your point, that's when I employ the dichotomy of control, right? When someone's like, I really like Andrew Tate. You know, if I know you and I love you, I will say, here's why you shouldn't, and here's why you shouldn't listen to him. But if it's, you know, just somebody else who doesn't have the ability to reason, I'm like, yeah, fill your boots. And because at the end of that rainbow, right, is external value. It's external, some kind of external reward, because he's telling people to do this, or this is how you have to act. This is the self-help I'm going to give you because it'll get you laid and you'll get money.
This is the formula. You know, it's always like, here's the formula. Yeah, here's the rule. Yeah. Just do this, to follow these steps. In modern research and psychotherapy, that's not really how we think about things. We think people have to figure things out for themselves and test them out in practice, and they have to be flexible and adaptive.
Follow these steps to happiness. Follow these steps to money.
That's why Pearson's book, 12 Rules, and he explains at the beginning why he's going to, is completely at odds
with
the fundamental insight in recent research and psychotherapy, which is like, no, rule-governed behavior is, you know, is problematic. The other thing I'd say about Andrew Tate, someone sent me the video where he talks about Marcus Aurelius, and I watched it a few times trying to wrap my head.
I was going to send it to you, but I always feel like I'm bugging you. Like,
no,
I
love things. It wasn't really a lot. It was kind of entertaining. It's not hard to watch. Like, so I watched it, and what's one of the things that struck me about it, kids, listen, kids, like I said, that I mentioned Stephen Covey earlier, you know, and I picked up Stephen Covey and I read it, and I thought, I really get the impression that this guy has thought through what he's saying more than it might appear at first. With Andrew Tate, what he sounded like to me, for someone that's giving self-help advice, it just came across to me as if he'd never really thought about this before. Like, so he's talking about how to cope with anger, I think he was talking about in that video. And some of the things he says sound like kind of slightly contradictory. Some of it sounds like he hasn't thought it through for more than 30 seconds. Like, he hasn't really thought about the implications or the consequences of certain strategies. I'm amazed that some of these guys that claim to be self-help experts, when you put them in the spot and say, how would you deal with anger then? Or how would you deal with anxiety? They kind of look like you've just asked them, you know, how would you defuse a bomb or something? Like, they're like, I don't know. Like, you know, they look like you've caught them off guard. And you think you're professing to be a self-help expert, and you give this advice to people, but that's the opposite of Stephen Covey, for instance. It comes across like you've barely thought about this before. Like, you're just making stuff up on the cuff. Right, basically, now that somebody's asked you. That was the vibe I got from that video. I would stand it beside something like that. There are people who do self-help that I think sound like they've spent time talking about stuff and thinking about it. He really struck me as, there are many things you could say to criticize Andrew Tate, obviously, but the one thing I'd say is it really just sounded like he hadn't spent much time thinking about it.
The Dean Blundell Show is brought to you by FactCheck.io. FactCheck.io, makers of the world's most comprehensive fact-checking software, that have been very busy building some software so that you can fact-check anything that you read. It doesn't matter. If it's got a URL, you'll be able to fact-check it. Alternative sources, origins, whether or not it was an organic or inorganic campaign, whether or not you can trust the people that are putting out the information, so that you can give yourself agency over information in the age of disinformation. Again, want to beta test their product? They're going to launch it in the next month or two. Go to factcheck.io today. FactCheck.io. Back to the show.
Hi, I'm Logan Anderson, host of the Say the Damn Score podcast. On my show, I deep dive into the sports broadcasting business by, you guessed it, talking to sportscasters. The show has featured big names like Bob Costas, Kenny Albert, and Vern Lundquist, as well as many up-and-coming broadcasters who you may not know yet, but you will know soon. Whether you're looking for professional development as a sportscaster, different career paths, or if you just want to be entertained by hearing some of the best storytellers in the world tell their own stories, this podcast is for you. You can subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, or you can visit our website, saythedamnscore.com.
Yeah. Well, you can tell when anybody talks about, like, anything to do with Marcus Aurelius or Stoicism or philosophy, right? Yeah, and keep in mind, I'm a baby at it. I've only been at it for a few years and always practicing. But, you know, within 3 seconds, usually, when someone's like, oh, you're into Stoicism, because I meet more and more people every day, which is fascinating, more and more people every day who will go, hey, I'm on to Stoicism, or you turn me onto it, because it's something that I think is content. It's something I like sharing with people, is the insight and the wisdom that comes from that philosophy and the people that were guarded with that philosophy, right? But you can tell when people, and to your point, the Andrew Tate video that you put up, and, you know, I watched Holiday with Rogan the other day, and Rogan was doing one of these where he's like, yeah, he was a really cool guy, right? Marcus Aurelius, he's a really cool guy. It's real cool.
And you can tell Joe Rogan says some strange things in that video.
Yeah, he really, really does. And it, and you can tell the people that are into the philosophy. It's like, you know, Ryan says it all the time. It's like, you know, don't read it, live it, be about it, like actively participate in what you're doing. And you can have a conversation with a stoic or someone who appreciates the value and the courage and the wisdom behind all the virtues and the values of courage and wisdom, temperance, grace, justice, all those other things. But when you talk to someone about it, and you're not looking for references to quotes. You're looking for some kind of like legitimate understanding that in a conversation, this person knows what they're talking about. And to your point, Andrew Tate did none of that. And on top of it, just weaponized the idea because he knew it was popular, right?
Actually, and I'm going to tell you something. Like, maybe you've probably got like little stories like this as well. But I tell your viewers something that they won't know, right? So, having written some books about Stoicism, I think, let me see how many times, maybe 3 times, roughly, people have approached me in private asking me to write content for them, like kind of ghostwrite stuff. So about Stoicism, right? So that they could pretend, basically. They would phrase it quite like that. There's one...
Hold on, because if you know anything about this space, Donald, if anybody knows anything about this space, is that Stoicism is a very hot property right now. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It really is.
Dean, look, there was this guy who's like quite a famous, like very wealthy, very successful, kind of in the self-improvement space dude, and has a whole marketing team around him and stuff like that. And he's my favorite example of this. So this dude was like, my marketing people tell me that a lot of our huge fan base are interested in Stoicism. So I wanted to do a series of videos like for them about Stoicism. And I thought that you could we could get you to write them. And I was like, what you mean? So you would be reading the videos though. You would be you'd be doing the videos and reading the scripts. I'd be writing them for you. I was a bit confused at first. And he was like, yeah, I thought you meant I would do some videos. No, you're going to speak the words that you want me to script for you. And this dude had never read any books on Stoicism and wasn't. And he said, I'm not really interested in Stoicism, but I want you to
write it like I am interested.
So I can pretend that I'm interested in Stoicism because our market research has told us that our audience are interested in that. And I thought, I don't know, man, a lot of the stuff in Stoicism is kind of about
it's your personal interpretation.
Yeah. It would be like saying, I want to pretend that I'm a Christian and I've never read the Bible, but yeah. I thought maybe you could write some sermons for me and I could stand up because I know a lot of our audience are Christian. I could pretend I'm a Christian. It would be very insincere and that kind of goes against deceitful. You know, it's not really consistent with the values or the philosophy to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Marcus
Aurelius was he treated truth like it was his own religion. So it's you know.
So it's kind of a weird thing to be asked, right? But I think there's a lot of the stuff we're talking about, I also think is common sense, right?
Yeah.
So at a common sense level, I think most worldly individuals will have met out in real life, there are guys that you meet and women that you meet who just think differently and really just think, I don't give a shit about the law, or what's moral. And they think everyone else is a sucker or an idiot, for playing by the rules, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they think, obviously, it's just about making stuff up to make as much money as you can. And
totally.
Why wouldn't you do that? You'd be a sucker not to do that. So they're all you meet people out just in day-to-day life that think like that. So of course there are self-improvement gurus that are just of course this is a facade and I'm just out to make money and I'll just make any of that. They think everyone else is crazy for not viewing life as cynically as that, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they do. They do. And you know what? It drives people that do the right thing and don't benefit from it nuts.
Yeah. But there are for sure there are people Stoicism has become a bit of a bandwagon and there are there are definitely, it's weird, but there are definitely people that have written books about it that haven't. I can think of at least, there are a couple of people that I know, at least like two or three people who either write books or do videos about Stoicism that have never actually read any of the, I mean, all like, you could read Marcus Aurelius in an afternoon,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, but there are people that will write about Stoicism because it's popular, right? Who haven't even bothered to read the books that they're talking about. Yeah.
That is in keeping with where we are today.
Yeah. It's messed up, right?
Performative, right?
It's performative, right? Mm-hmm. I did a thing the other day, like I said to people, what's your favorite quote from Marcus Aurelius? And I mean, I'd need to count, but off the top of my head, I think about maybe around about 15, 20%, probably like 10 or 15%, I think, of the quotes that people posted weren't real. They were like bogus, fake quotes, misattributed quotes. Like, because the internet's absolutely awash with these like bogus quotations. And mm-hmm. some of them are so common that you find them in, like, there are books that are full of them, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you another crazy story, right? I was talking to someone who wrote a book about Stoicism. Like, they'd actually written a book that was about something else. And then when Stoicism became popular, they changed the title of the book to be about Stoicism. And they showed it to me and I looked at it and I was like, but this is like, this isn't this just the same book, but you've just changed the title? And they were like, yeah, like, you know, again, like, well, why wouldn't I?
But did they include anything about Stoicism in the previously?
No, there wasn't anything about Stoicism in it. Like, they just didn't change the title of the book. It's crazy. That's how nuts people are, right? And then the other one, like, there was a quote that they used that was about Socrates, which I read and I was like, immediately, that this isn't something that Socrates ever said, right? It's just like a made-up self-improvement quote that people misattribute to him on the internet. And normal, like a normal regular person would probably go, oh man, I'm so embarrassed. Like, yeah, that sucks. I guess I'll take that out. And the person that I was speaking to said, well, like, I don't care. Like, you know, it doesn't really matter. I still think it's a good quote. I'm going to like keep it in, like the audience won't know. And I was like, again, it's like some people just are so far gone.
Yeah, they
like,
don't care.
That they're like, I don't care. Like, so what difference does it make to me as long as the audience don't realize?
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I was like, but it's wrong, right? Is this not a thing he ever said? Like, it's just made up. But you're going to keep that in your book.
Yeah.
Like, knowing that it's a bogus quotation.
That was the start of the meme industry, I think.
Like, it's
that guy. Like, I mean, it's amazing to me that people will do that. They'll misrepresent anything. But we live in that misrepresentation age too, right? Where misrepresentation can sometimes be the difference between keeping someone donating to you and not keeping someone donating to you.
I mention it because I think your audience, like, people need to be warned in some ways, or just to be like conscious that there's that level of disregard for truth and, you know, like cynicism among a lot of people, even that work in the self-help industry. Mm. Yeah, like it sounds like you wouldn't believe it, right? But then if, when you move in certain circles and you interact with it, you're like, you see this and you're like, for real? Like, you're like that cynical. You're just gonna like, hey, could you teach me how to pretend that I'm into this philosophy? Like,
that's the thing, right? Like, if I pretend, well, I know there's a lot of money in, but if I pretend, I think about going down that road sometimes because, like, you help people. You are a cognitive behavioral therapist. I am not. I help just dudes not drink, and I don't charge people for it. It's not something that I, you know, I'm like, I can't take your money. I'm just trying to help you understand, give you some resources and point you in the right direction, and you can go and figure out the rest yourself. Invariably, we always talk about Stoicism because it's behavioral that is the issue with every alcoholic, right? So there's this nice little linchpin for both of them. But I don't make stuff up. Like, yeah, I don't like, make.
Why would you? Why? I mean, it's weirdly lazy. Like, why would you need to? Like,
I don't need to be anybody's swabby.
Because it takes time. One of the things that's quite common is a lot of them just don't read the books, right? Mm-hmm. So they are like, I'm amazed how common that is. Like that. Like you read books, right? This seems like such a weird thing to have to say. A lot of people don't read. right?
Well, a lot of people read, don't read, but they say they read too. I find that a lot.
So some of the people that want to jump on the self-help bandwagon are people that, I don't read books. Why would I go and read like Plato's Dialogues or something like that? Like, I don't got time to do that. But they want to jump in the Stoicism. Now, if you're talking about classics and philosophy, it's kind of hard to talk about it without at least reading the stuff that you're talking about. But a lot of these people just don't read and they can't be bothered reading, but want to have a slice of that cake. Mm-hmm. And so you get in a situation where I think there is quite a lot of garbage,
charlatans, people that misrepresent, people that want to latch onto a trend. And the reason why this is trendy, the reason why Stoicism, and I actually give you credit, I give Ryan credit, I give a couple other, key influencers in this space that understand the popularization of Stoicism to people in 2024 on a 2,000-year-old ancient philosophy. But the reason why people that it's hot is it works, and it only works if you do the work behind, the philosophy that is Stoicism, which is like accountable stuff, right? But that's the point. That the irony in the whole idea that someone's like, I'm going to fake this religion, makes me laugh every time.
Well, then you get to the extreme of Andrew Tate making a video out of it, and then his description of it bearing no resemblance to that. And I'm pretty, like you say, I don't think he's read Marks of Relief, right? It didn't come across like he had. He didn't refer to or mention anything that the Stoics say. He just went, he started talking about Bugattis actually at one point in that video, I swear. Yeah. And then he gives this kind of generic self-help advice that he sees as Stoicism. Actually, it's the opposite of what the Stoics taught. So you get people saying, literally saying, hey, I'm into Marcus Aurelius and I'm totally into Stoicism. And I think you should go to the gym and kind of work out. Like he must realize, if you've read Marcus Aurelius, there's nowhere that Marcus really says anything like that. What Marcus does say is, you need to identify what your values are and what the beliefs are that are making you angry. And there are different strategies that you could use to help you evaluate that. It bears no resemblance to what he's saying. So it comes across like he's just jumping on the bandwagon and making up superficial advice that has the potential to be really misleading to people if they watch that and then think, oh, that's why people are into Stoicism, because it teaches you to go to the gym to vent your anger or whatever. Or the other things that he says, right? They think they're getting advice about what something is from somebody who maybe hasn't even read anything about it. It's completely fabricated.
Guaranteed he didn't. Yeah. Guaranteed he didn't.
So I guess there's a warning there for people as to, buyer beware kind of thing. You have to be a little bit cautious. And I've had people argue with me online about the Stoics say this or that, and I think, where are you getting this from? They've got it from some weird video or blog post or whatever written by someone that's probably never read the Stoics, and it filters down into, so we do have, I think you're right that we have almost a population of people at the moment who believe that they're into Stoicism, but the idea of Stoicism that they have is completely distorted. So it's completely back to front because they've got it filtered down to them from these people that aren't really interested in the subject and are only trying to get in on it because it's popular.
Cash in a hashtag, yeah.
That would happen with I'm sure that's happened with, in a sense, with Christianity, with Buddhism, with any popular kind of with cognitive therapy, it happens a lot. You'll get people who say that they're CBT therapists, and then what they're doing bears no resemblance to what we actually do in CBT. I think as a therapist, we see this all the time. So you have a client that comes to see you and you say, hey, have you ever had therapy before? So you're taking their history, right? You take their treatment history. Hey, I had therapy before. Oh yeah, I had CBT. Oh really? Well, that's cool, right? So then we're not starting from scratch, right? So what did you do in the previous CBT? And they'll describe doing stuff that bears no resemblance. And then you say, okay, so in CBT for anxiety, we'd normally create a hierarchy of exposure, maybe, and then we'd get you to face your fears and your imagination, maybe kind of monitor your thinking in response to that, you know, help you critically question some of the thoughts that might be causing your anxiety. Do you do it? No, I didn't do any of that. Like, that's like the like basic stuff that we do. So what were you doing? How many, I had like 20 sessions of CBT. What did you do? Like, you know, you basically, someone called what they were doing CBT, and what they did with the client was, who knows? Like,
gave him a pamphlet, listen to some music, maybe just close your eyes for 20 minutes.
Something like that. God only knows, right? But then, like, so that's kind of parallels what happened with Stoicism a little bit, if we're not careful. But I think the thing with Stoicism is that, to some extent, I hope that anyone that kind of really gets it, even if they watch an Andrew Tate video and it makes them curious about Stoicism, that they might, perhaps unlike Andrew Tate, go away and just read the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. And then when they read that, they might think, hey, this seems quite different from the stuff that he said in that video. And then maybe we always have that saving grace that it's where Stoicism will always kind of steer people to looking at the original text, in the same way that people might go to a really weird Christian church, but at some point, hopefully, they just go and read the Bible for themselves and think, some of the stuff that's like in here doesn't say anything about like hating homosexuals. And in fact, where's the bit where Jesus says you should get a placard, like, about, you know, like, I hate fags or whatever, and I can't find it anywhere in this book.
Yeah, where's that thing that says gay people are sin? Like, where's that to say in here? I can't find it. Consider the source. And men are always going to be wild cards. Humanity is always the wild card when it comes to destroying anything that we've created for the betterment of ourselves. It's just kind of one of those things. Donald J. Robertson is our guest today. He is a cognitive behavioral therapist. He is a Stoic author. He is an historian. Are you still doing Plato's Academy, by the way?
Yeah, I'm the founder and the president of a nonprofit based in Greece called the Plato's Academy Center. I'm going back to Athens in a few weeks to stay there for a couple of months, and I'll be working on that.
I might join you. I might just pop in and say hi and tag along and destroy your vacation. Yeah.
Yeah.
The new book is called Marcus Aurelius, The Stoic Emperor. It's available on Amazon, anywhere you get your fine books. Don't stop there. Go backwards to the prequel to that. Is How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, The Stoic Philosophy of Marcus Aurelius. Donald J. Robertson is his name. Plato's Academy. Google it. Donald Robertson on Twitter. He's a great follow, too. He's way nicer than everybody else on Twitter, but he makes all kinds of sense. And listen, as I said to start this, you know, there are people that unknowingly, because of the passion of the information that they convey, like you, like Ryan, a few other people, and, of course, Marcus, and Seneca, and Epictetus, that have made a big difference in my life. And I want to thank you for that, and continued success and good luck with the book, dude. Honest to God, I've got two copies coming here. My son is very much interested in your material. He is practicing Stoic as well. Awesome. So we're going to share that with people, and really appreciate you taking 3 hours.
You're welcome. I told you.
What does this cost if I have to pay for it? Like, if we're doing therapy, this has got to be a couple grand that you just gave me. Like, yeah. I feel like I owe you something.
Pretty expensive. But you're welcome. It's my pleasure. Thank you. And I like talking about my hobby.
your hobby and the understanding that goes into it continues to change lives. So thank you very much. I appreciate it, Donald.
Been a pleasure.
We'll talk to you soon. Donald Robertson, Donald J. Robertson, author, Stoic author. Can't say enough about these books. Marcus Aurelius, The Stoic Emperor. I read it yesterday. It's a pretty raw look into the life of what went into making this man who became Stoicism, right? And the life that he led and what he had to do and the discipline and the moderation. And, of course, there's this book, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor. Great companion books, great pieces. And to Donald's point, you're going to be in this stuff forever if you get into it, because it's not a religion. It's just, man, you know, I'm feeling jammed up about this. It's how do I respond? How do I perceive life in front of me? And how do I be good to people around me so that I can have a good life? How do I change the things that I do on a daily basis to reflect the kind of life that I want to have? And it's not that difficult. It really isn't. It comes with some humility, too. I know there's a bunch of people out there like me that actually benefit from the humble piece. Yeah. Not born with that. Anyway, thanks to Donald for joining us. Don't forget, everything we do can be found at Cryer Media, brought to you by our friends at CanTorque, making rugged, hardworking torque wrenches for 20 years, Canada's leading industrial tool experts. the very best in tool rentals, calibration services, rentals, repairs, fabrication, distribution opportunities. Yeah, they've got jobs too. If you want one, they'll give you one if you're good at this. Cantorque offers a complete range of products, services, and solutions for bolting that you cannot find one for. Nuclear, railroad, heavy industry, doesn't matter. Make sure you give them a ringy ding dong. They put a little maple leaf on all their products, and they ship around the world as well. Boring machines, it doesn't matter. Yeah, they make those, the torque wrenches for tunnel boring machines, like massively. They're the best in the world at it. They do work all over the world, industrial tools and torque wrenches like nobody else. Go to their new website today, cantorque.com. As well, brought to you by Muse Massage Spa, clinical sexologists that help you, entertain you, understand that business in the body house industry. Muse Massage Spa, 1290 Finch Avenue West. $20 off your first session. Go there today. And by the way, download their podcast, Muse on the Mic. It's a really, really, really good one. They've got a Patreon channel. And fellas, I've got another thing for you too. I've got your new underwear, Gitch, edsfineimports.com. Clothing for men and boys. The clothing that you wear can be on you, but you want something that's comfortable. You can look great and have a bad pair of underwear on and walk around all day and go, I hate these things. You will never say that about Gitch. That you can only get at edsfineimports.com. Gitch3 is your promo code. Buy one, get one free. Buy three, rather, get one free. They've got a four-pack. You can get a four-pack for the price of three. That's how the promo code works. Gitch3, bunch of different colors. Luxury boxer briefs, pouch in the front, made for everyday performance. You can walk, run, or sprint through life. And right now, 15% off your entire purchase. You can receive and access new arrivals, promotions, contest invites, and more at edsfineimports.com. But he's Gitch for the business, so go and download that whole package today and make sure his package is on your package. Gitch, engineered for any level of performance. Edsfineimports.com. And, of course, brought to you by factcheck.io. Do you believe what you read? Do you believe what you see? Do you believe the videos? Do you believe the pictures? Do you believe the news stories? You want to. So the good people at Fact Check here are going to give you a companion, a free tool that'll help you figure out what you're looking at is real or not. And then you can actually weaponize the fact that you have just checked and send it away to people that need to be corrected. Truth is at a premium. Disinformation is a killer. And this is the disinformation killer for the 21st century. Factcheck.io. Now beta testing. You can join their beta team by going to factcheck.io, factcheck.io, and joining their beta testing team. They will be launching and you will get your own dashboard and you will be a verified fact checker. And boy, you just get to work saying, is this real? Is this real? Is this real? Social media posts, doesn't matter if it's a news story, picture, video, written word, the Shazam of fact checking. Go to factcheck.io, factcheck.io. And join their beta testing team today. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks to Donald for joining us. Don't forget to get his book, Marcus Aurelius, The Stoic Emperor, wherever you get your books. It'll only change your life, kids. It'll only change your life. Have a great day. See you tomorrow. Bye.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first five episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all three of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
Kits. I'm your eager beaver.
And I'm Mr. Grizzly.
If you love politics
or hate politics,
then have we the perfect podcast for you.
The True North Eager Beaver.
Incisive political commentary.
We keep you up to date
and give you the political and media literacy you seek
to help you
cut through the bovine fecal matter.
Facts first.
Sound analysis.
Sometimes I growl.
Sometimes I sass.
We impart civics and build community.
And we share some laughs along the way.
Being informed
and engaged has never been more fabulous
or sexy. Catch us on the Dean Blundell Network or on our YouTube channel
or wherever you get your podcasts,
because democracy is something you do.